Welcome to episode 102 of the Martin Bailey Photography Podcast. Today we have a special treat for you. I'm joined by two of the members, prominent members of the MBP community, and of course, amazing photographers. First, we have Forrest Tanaka.
Hello, everyone, from very hot California.
And also Evan Solberg.
Hello, in not so hot Norway.
So, welcome, guys, and thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us today. Especially Forrest, I know that it's early for you.
Yes, very.
it's a bit of a pain. This is really the only way that we could get me and you, and then on the phone at the same time, but also allow Evan to join. And I'm really pleased that we did it that way. So a little bit of a pain, but thanks for doing that, and thanks for giving up part of your Sunday afternoon, Evan.
No problem.
Okay, so we're going to actually do this today pretty similar to a Focus Ring podcast, and that's on the Photocast network that I sometimes join in. And basically, if you haven't checked that out, actually, look in, go to photocastnetwork.com or search in iTunes for that. And we've just released episode 8. I wasn't involved in that one, but if you want to take a listen to that, please do. And so we were going to have another member with us today, but I think that one of the guys was saying earlier they're probably lost in the mountains. So we're going to have the three of us, and Forrest is going to talk about his digital workflow using a Mac. Evan is going to talk about when do you not take the shot or stop shooting. And I'm going to answer a question that I received recently from a listener about when I use manual focus. So I guess we should just get right into it then, guys.
Okay.
Yeah, sounds good.
So again, welcome, guys. It's great to be talking with you after having interacted with you for so long on the MBP community.
Well, I'm surprised you're still talking to us.
No, it's really great. I mean, you add so much, and I appreciate all of your words of wisdom and your sort of friendship and everything that you do on there. It's great.
Yeah, thanks a lot. It's been an amazing environment, and it's taught me basically everything I've learned over the past couple of years.
That's good to know, Forrest. Thanks. Let's see. As I mentioned, we've got a few topics that we're going to talk about, and does either of you want to go first, or shall we just jump straight into it? I can go first, or you guys can, either one of you.
Oh, why don't you go first, Martin?
Okay, will do. So, like I say, I was going to answer a question that I received from a listener, Julian Seidenberg, who is currently doing a PhD in Manchester in the UK. And Julian had sent me two questions, and I'm going to answer one of them. The second one I'll answer in a podcast within the next few weeks, hopefully. The question was, when and where do you use manual focus? And sort of paraphrasing a little bit on the rest of Julian's question, he goes on to say, all lenses can be manually focused. Do you ever use this feature? For macro work, you'd like to control the focus yourself and also use manual focus to preset the focus to the hyperfocal distance in landscape shots. Are there any other scenarios where manual focus is better? Do you use any older lenses that do not have autofocus and therefore have to be focused manually? And is there a good technique for manually focusing on fast-moving subjects or when you need to take a picture quickly because of the fleeting moment? And I guess there's about five questions in there, actually, rather than just one. But to sort of attack them one by one, for starters, the first two statements are exactly right. I use manual focus 95% of the time for my macro work. And basically, when I'm using the 100mm macro lens that has autofocus, that works very well. I tend to sort of switch to manual and then just sort of turn the focus ring so that it goes right down to the shortest possible focus distance and then move the camera in until the subject comes into focus. And then I know that I'm at one-to-one or life size. When I'm doing that and I want to be at one-to-one, I sometimes use focusing rails to move the camera back and forth. But my other macro lens, which is an MPE 65mm 1-5 times life size lens, that doesn't even have autofocus, so I shoot at one magnification and move it around on the focusing rails. But I've been into this in previous podcasts, so I'm not going to go into that today. Basically, though, yes, you're right. And also for shooting hyperfocal distance, yes, I switched to manual with the little switch on the lens barrel, and then set the focus to the using the distance scale on the top of the lens, and then just shoot away. So if you want to listen to more about that as well, like I say, I've spoken about this before, so I'm not going to go into details today. It was episode 65 that I did on hyperfocal distance. So just sort of quickly moving through so that until we can get to a more interactive part. Do you use any lenses that have autofocus and therefore focus therefore force you to focus manually? So, like I say, apart from the MPE macro lens, I have a 24mm TSE. I think this is one of the lenses that you're lusting over at the moment, isn't it, Evan?
A TSE definitely is, yes. I haven't decided whether to go for the 24 or 45 or whatever, but that macro lens is actually right now on top of my wish list, along with the 1DS, so I'll probably get that first, actually.
Ah, okay, that's pretty cool. So going back to answering the question, where are we? Do you have any older lens? Yeah, so the 24mm TSE actually doesn't have any autofocus. It probably would be just too difficult to work that with all of the tilting and shifting that the lens can do. So, yes, I use it. I do use manual focus there. The question goes on, is there a good technique for manually focusing even on fast-moving subjects or to capture a fleeting moment? And I think this is the part that I really had to think about. It's not just sort of saying yes or no. I've personally found that the best thing for fast-moving objects is to use the AI or artificial intelligence, I think it is, servo, AI servo, which is, of course, autofocus. So, like for shooting birds that move around pretty quickly, fly overhead, things like that, I generally tend to use this mode. And also, you know, you can use single shot autofocus and just sort of keep half pressing and then recomposing. But again, it's autofocus. So I really don't. For the first part, I really don't use manual focus. To capture a fleeting moment, too, I generally tend to use autofocus unless I know exactly where the fleeting moment is going to occur. So, for example, you know, you could, if you were, say, shooting people passing by an opening in a doorway or something, you could just sort of focus on the pavement at a point where you know the person's going to be and then just wait for that fleeting moment to happen, kind of sort of pre-visualize the shot. So, yes, that's one time where you could use manual focus and it probably would help. But, again, I'm really not sure that I would go that far with the autofocus being so fast on modern lenses. So do either Forrest or Evan, do you have any input on that?
Well, one thing, I can't remember who told me this, but one thing that's helped me a lot is to use a custom function to remove autofocus away from the shutter button. So when I press a shutter, the only thing that happens automatically is exposure if I'm in one of those modes. But the actual autofocus, I moved to the... Actually, I don't remember what this button does completely, but I think it's the one that zooms out when you're looking at the photos on the LCD.
Yeah, it's the FEL button, the exposure lock button, the star on the back. Right.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I find that helps me a lot.
That sounds good. That's a good... I've never really tried that. I've seen the custom function, but I've never really played with it.
Yeah, it... it lets me sort of separate in my mind what I'm doing so that I'll set up the focus first using that button on the back. But once I'm there, then I just start shooting away. And just if I'm in an automatic mode, then I'll just be worrying about the exposure at the moment I press the shutter.
Mm. Sounds cool. Yeah. Evan, do you have any tips on that?
Well, it's interesting because for me, a lot of the photography I do, like portraits, for example, for me, focusing and exposure is sort of one operation. So I'll focus and check the exposure at more or less at the instant when I take the picture. So for me, I haven't tried moving focusing to the back. But coming back to the macro thing, I have the Canon 180 millimeter macro with a couple of extension tubes, and I find I use it in manual mode as well for the majority of the time. It's like I put it on there for the first time, did the auto exposure thing, switched to manual, and I really never looked back.
Yeah, I think specifically with manual shots, not manual, with macro shots, I really just tend to use it a lot. I need to go back. Yeah, there was another part of the question here that probably is going to be linked to what I was about to say. So I'll move on to the last part of Julian's question, which was, are there any other scenarios where manual focus is better? And what I was just thinking was when I'm shooting things like products, I don't do a lot of this. Usually just to show you guys things on the podcast. But when I'm shooting product shots with a backdrop and some simple lighting, I generally just drop the camera on a tripod and then switch to manual focus, and then sort of focus on the point that I want to have, get it all set up, and then I'll start to just take a few. I don't even look through the finder for a while after that. I'll just sort of adjust the lighting and then sort of trip the shutter with the remote release, and then check it on the LCD, and then just sort of move things around a little bit. And I'll generally do all of that without even looking through the finder for a while. So that was the time that I could think where manual focus is better, apart from the ones that we've already noticed.
Well,
is there any?
Yeah. There is one more, and that is in low light situation when your autofocus is unable to determine where to focus. Say you have a low contrast scene in with little light, then you'll have to switch to manual in order to get the shot at all, because if autofocus can't find anything to lock onto, you'll never be able to get the shot at all.
Right, good one. Yeah, I've been there, and that's a great example. Another good tip there.
And another time that I always switch to manual focus, or at least stop pressing the button on the back, is for panoramas. Manual everything.
Yep. So now we're proving now that three heads are definitely better than one. So yeah, that they're good examples. I do that myself. Great stuff. So does anybody have anything else to add on this topic before we move on?
You know, one thing that surprised me, I haven't shot many sports, but this past year I did shoot my daughter's school's basketball team. And I was certain that manual focus would be better, but it turned out to be a disaster. I mean, I could hardly save any of the shots from that shoot. And I ended up doing automatic on just about all of those.
Yeah, I was thinking to maybe go into this a bit, but I wasn't going to do it for the sake of time. But now I've started off.
Now that I've ruined it.
I was thinking I was going to briefly mention that, years ago there was no autofocus, right? So people, I know that sports photographers and a lot of photographers in days of old, when nights were old, basically they had to use manual focus, right? So they were probably masters at it, and they could just probably swizz the lens, the focus ring around, and get things spot on without any messing around. But we've been spoiled over the last sort of 10, 15 years, right? Or maybe 20 years. Things have just got so good that we don't even really have to rely on it anymore.
But coming back to... Go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, okay. One thing... I haven't really gotten into photography until after the digital revolution, basically. And so I haven't had a lot of exposure to manual focus. And so it is kind of a different paradigm, if I could use that word, where manual focus is sort of the backup just when things don't work.
Right, yeah. That's pretty similar to me.
A couple of comments. First of all, when we're talking about the sports and the autofocus thing, the AI servo function on your camera is there for a reason, and specifically for sports and stuff like that, to make sure that you stay in focus. But another problem with manual focus is that on a 35 millimeter or let alone a crop camera, the viewfinder is so small it's hard to determine when you're actually in focus. I have a focusing screen for my 5D, which helps, but I also have an old Mamiya medium format camera, and on a 6x7 frame, determining focus is a lot easier. So I can only imagine what it would be like on a 4x5 or let alone an 8x10, which is huge.
Mm. Yeah, yeah, that's a good point. I mean, I guess that's probably one of the reasons why I said earlier about the AI servo. I use that a lot for shooting birds when they're flying out, like the red crown cranes that I go to shoot every so often. When they fly overhead, there's no time to mess around, you know, turning that ring around. And I am sure that years ago people could have done this, but you're probably right that they probably wouldn't have been doing that very successfully with if we'd have all of a sudden taken away, part of the brightness of their viewfinder by cropping the film to 1.6 or 1.5 or something like that. That would have made things a lot worse, a lot more difficult. I think that's a really good point. That's probably why we just don't even try it very often these days.
Yeah, and also I wear glasses, and my eyesight with glasses is good, but it puts me just a little bit farther away from the viewfinder. And that does make it tougher.
Yeah, I can imagine. Okay, so that lots of great points there. I'm glad we are talking about this interactively. So is there anything to add before we move on? Okay.
Not for me.
Okay, great. So tell you what then, let's move on. So let's just go to Forrest. If I say which one wants to go first, we're probably going to end up waiting again. So Forrest, do you want to move on to your topic on your Mac workflow?
Sure. I don't know how many Mac users there are on your site. I've noticed, being a moderator of the site, I noticed you can actually see what machines people are using to visit the site. And I've noticed, you know, most of it says Windows XP. I also noticed whenever someone visits with a Mac, it doesn't say that. It just says unknown.
Okay.
So, but I've noticed there's more unknowns than I was expecting, so hopefully this will apply to people. For me, I suppose the biggest factor in my workflow is speed, because being able to go through all the photos quickly makes me less aware, I guess, or thinking about during a shoot of how much time it's going to take if I take, you know, 5 shots in a row. And so my basic philosophy is going through multiple passes, just like probably most people do, going through multiple passes and trying to reduce vastly the number of photos that are involved at each pass. And so right now I'm completely laptop based, and so I can take using the camera bag, courtesy of LoPro and courtesy of you, which has a laptop slot in it. I just, on most shoots, I'll just bring the laptop with me. And whenever there's a risk of overflowing the two gig flash cards that I have, I'll just grab the card reader and download it to the local hard drive. And so what I use is the program that comes with macOS. It's this minuscule, tiny little program called Image Capture to download all the RAWs. And the Finder, which in the Windows world I've never quite known what to equate it with, I guess the desktop, it will build the thumbnails from those RAWs. And from that, I'll do my initial pass, which is just to get rid of all the ridiculous ones where the subject isn't even in the frame or the exposure is completely, completely off or the focus is off. And I'll just run through that real quickly, like no more than maybe a minute to cover, you know, the couple hundred shots. And then from there, once I'm at home, I'll start up Aputure. I've been using Apple's Aputure probably for a little more than a year, I would guess, and start doing the import. Let's see. The way I have it arranged, because hard drive space is such a issue here, is I have a 160 gigabyte Seagate portable USB drive, and that's my RAW drive. All my RAWs go on there. So when I do the import, I'll have Aputure copy the files from my local hard drive to this portable drive, and the Aputure database will just reference those files right there. And so what that lets me do is I can just carry this portable hard drive with me wherever I go and always have all my RAW files there. And let's see. At that stage, Aputure is keeping track of everything, so I go through the next pass, which is to take each photo full screen and just use the arrow keys to move through it. And what I'll do is sort of like the last pass of just getting rid of what I now see as the ridiculous ones, ones where the focus was good enough that I didn't notice it was wrong in the first pass, but now I can see that it's wrong now. And at this stage, and how I do it is I just keep my one hand on the arrow keys to go through the photos and the other hand on the ratings keys. And I'll either rate it as a reject, which is the 9 key, for all the ones I really don't want to keep. And I'm pretty brutal at this stage. I don't have a lot of emotional attachments to my photos at this stage. So anything that I just don't see me using, I'll just reject it right there. And for the ones that are, you know, maybe I can do something with, I'll rate it 1. The ones that are a little better than that, I'll rate it 2. And anything that I want to take farther in the workflow, I'll rate it as a 3. And I won't rate anything 4s or 5s at this stage. And this usually, I mean, I was talking to you, Martin, right after coming back from a car race where I think it was 741 photos. And in about a half an hour through that process, I had it down to about 250.
That's good.
Yeah. And so then I'll go through the next pass, which is to... actually, before I go through the next pass, then I go to this automatic album, I guess, which Aputure uses just to collect all the rejects. And at that stage, I'll just delete them all right there. The next stage, I think, is very Aputure-specific, I think. I haven't used Lightroom in a while, so I'm not sure if they added this after the beta period. It's the what I call the stacking pass. Aputure has this concept of a stack where you can just arbitrarily group photos together. And usually it'll be, you know, if you took 5 shots of one thing in the hope of getting a good one, you'll just put all those in a stack. And the stack will have what's called a stack pick, which is the photo that represents the stack. And so, but at this stage, all I'm doing is stacking. I'm just looking at all the photos that are similar to each other and put them in a stack. And there's also an auto-stacking mechanism they have, which is based on how far apart in time the photos are taken. But I almost never use that. It's just better to do it manually. And so at that stage, things are usually compressed a lot. And at that stage, then I'll go through, in a sense, the final pass, which I call the promotion pass. And what I'll do is any photos that really stand out, I'll give it a 4-star. And things that really stand out, I'll give a 5-star, although that has probably happened about twice in the past year. And I'll also go through each of the stacks I made and pick the best one in the stack. And usually that involves whatever looks sharpest. But, you know, the usual other factors will get involved here. And at the end of that, I'll just have usually a pretty small set of photos of all the, you know, 4s and 5 stars, plus all the 3 stars with the pick of the stack set as the what I'll see as a thumbnail. And from there, anything that I want to take any further, like display on a website or make a print of, I'll do some basic exposure corrections. Mm-hmm. I don't really do, I know a lot of people try to do everything in either Lightroom or Aperture, you know, get all the exposures right, get all the dirt cloned out. Mm-hmm. I usually don't do much beyond the exposure slider, the contrast slider, and maybe the brightness slider. There is a levels section, which is a lot like the curve section of Lightroom. But I almost never do anything with it. What I do is just take it into, after doing the basic exposure corrections, I'll just take it into Photoshop. Now, the problem I had with that, which happened pretty quickly, is running out of disk space for the PSD files. So just recently, I picked up a 300 gigabyte FireWire 800 drive. So now, whenever I right-click on a photo to open it up in Photoshop, Aperture will create that photo on that external drive. Now, unfortunately, it's a desktop drive, so I can't carry these with me anywhere. So whatever I have on the road is just my RAWs, and my Photoshop files will be missing, unfortunately. Once they start making a terabyte portable drive, I can probably go back to the old way of doing things. But that's probably not going to happen for a while.
Yeah, about a month.
Right.
with the way things are moving.
Yeah. Actually, I noticed they finally, I think it was Toshiba, released a 200 gigabyte portable drive. Wow. But I'm just going to fill that up pretty quickly, too. And so in Photoshop is where I'll do most of the cloning and a lot of the, even a lot of the exposure parts of it, whatever I couldn't do quickly in Aperture. Mm. And from there, it either goes to the web or wherever. Now, I actually, you know, Aperture does have, you know, its own sharpening, but I find I trust Photoshop for just about anything beyond the basics. And so, you know, I'll size it to the final size and sharpen there and end up with a lot of Photoshop files. And fortunately, Aperture does keep your Photoshop files in your stack. And you can make that the stack pick as well. So that all happens pretty easily. And that's basically the gist of it, of my Mac workflow.
That's great. There's a few things there that I find really interesting. I think it's really cool that you can, you know, because you take your laptop out in the field with you, you can do a lot of that editing you know, right away. That's something that is really appealing. I guess it's good to get home knowing that you've done part of it.
Yeah, and actually, I just went to Lake Tahoe for a couple of days this past week, and. Did exactly that. Downloaded the pictures right in the cabin and did the basic editing right there. And yeah, it works really well.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I mean, I don't have a good enough laptop to do that, but I can really see the benefits of being able to do that. That's cool stuff.
Yeah, most of the problem is I only have, well, 2 gigabytes of DRAM. And with Aperture and Photoshop and, you know, I do a lot of page layout, too, so sometimes I have Aperture and Photoshop and Illustrator and InDesign all open at the same time.
Wow.
And it really starts to slow down with two gigabytes.
Mm-hmm. So do you – one question. I was you know, I'm listening to your, you know, you talk about this. Is Aperture non-destructive? You know, if you're working on RAW files, does it save them – save the changes in the XML files like was it XMS? I forget. Like Lightroom does?
Yeah, it's basically the same thing. It doesn't use the sidecar files like Lightroom. I guess optionally does, right? But it does keep it in its own database. This is sort of a... You can actually, and by default, I think, use this database as your monolithic photo database. So all your RAWs can go in it, all your Photoshop files go in it, and all the, you know, basically the XMS data goes in it as well. But that's right, it is non-destructive.
Ah, that's good. I was hoping that I'd be able to use Lightroom like that, but I found a 50,000 image cap. As soon as I go over 50,000 images in Lightroom, it just dies on me. I can't get any, the instant previews and things that I'm used to now with the Fast Machine and Lightroom just goes away, and I'm waiting minutes for each image to show. So I've had to split my library up.
I remember you mentioning that.
Yeah. Well, what I was going to say about, you know, when I asked about aperture, whether aperture is non-destructive or not, I was thinking that a lot of the things that I mean, I don't do a lot of editing on my images once I get into Photoshop. The main thing that I've done has been just dust spotting, you know, and every so often I'll take a couple of images and I'll merge them together to overcome, you know, as we would have done with a neutral grad filter to darken the sky or something like that. I'll now do that sort of thing in Photoshop. But apart from that, I'm really just using it as an expensive dust spotter. So, you know, now that I think it was actually Evan, I think it was you that pointed out to me a month or so ago maybe, that there is now a decent dust spotter in Lightroom. So yeah, I was getting that really sort of around my neck, and I wasn't using it properly. Now I know, thanks to Evan, that, you know, you just sort of use your scroll wheel on your mouse, and that changes the size of it, and then just click it, and it'll then go away and find what it thinks is the right place to clone from. And I was thinking that was going all haywire, but it's just showing you exactly where to do it. So it's actually quite a lot more intuitive. And what I was going to say, sorry? Yeah.
Yeah, and you can also move the source spot around. If it doesn't
find
one that fits, you can always move it around.
Yeah, and what I'm finding now is that because I want to keep those changes, you know, where I dust spotted is actually all saved as well. So I can keep that in a non-destructive thing, and then so later when I come to the only reason I'm not trying to negate your workflow at all, Forrest. I'm just trying to add a little something here. But what I find is that when we work on a raw file, we sort of, you know, we do all of the work in, if we do all of the work in Photoshop, then when your raw processing software becomes a little bit better, some point down the road, then, you know, we're going to have to reprocess it from RAW, and then we're going to have to do all of that dust spotting again. So I'm thinking that if it can be done in Lightroom and saved in sidecar files, then we'll be able to output a RAW with all of the dust spotting as well in a year or so's time. And that's why I'm kind of starting to do more of that in Lightroom.
Martin?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I would actually like to do more dust spotting in Aperture itself, and it has that tool, but I just find it too awkward to use. It just sort of tries to, it looks like it's just sort of trying to merge things from around it together, and it looks very strange. And you can make it so that it uses a different source, but I just found it too awkward. I think if there was a more intuitive tool in Aperture, I'd do that more.
One thing I find is very handy in Lightroom is if I've done dust spotting on one image, I can then select a number of other images and tell Lightroom to sync my settings onto those images. So I can have the same dust spotting settings in a bunch of images. And worst case, I'll move the sources around a little, but I find that really speeds up the whole process for me.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I think it's going to really sort of come into its own when we can do this non-destructively and portably. So yeah, I agree. I made a few notes while you were talking, Forrest. The other thing I was thinking was that stacking. I know that there's something similar to this. I don't know, Evan. Do you know if we have that in Lightroom?
Oh, absolutely, yes, and you can tell it even to stack on a certain time span. So, say, stack all images that were taken within 5 seconds of each other, for example.
Yeah, I've really not got into this at all yet, so maybe I should. I know that you're big on this, Forrest. You've mentioned it before. So
yeah, I'm very big on that. It's good to see Lightroom has that, because by the time I sort of left the Lightroom beta program, they still hadn't had that in yet. But I did hear, I think it was Jeff Curtis was mentioning in one of the focus rings that it had that feature.
Okay. So, Evan, did you have anything that you wanted to add on Forrest's topic?
Well, my workflow is similar but a bit different to Forrest's. First of all, I don't have a personal laptop. I have a desktop computer. So, but I have a fair amount of compact flash. So what I do is when I get home, I convert everything to DNG on import. So that takes away the need for the sidecar file to begin with. And then what I do is I have a piece of software on my XP machine that automatically copies everything onto an external drive that I have, which has RAID 1 on it. And I tell it, only copy, do not mirror, delete operations. So anything I do to my images on my main work drive will not be replicated onto my backup drive. So I have online backup of all my pictures. I'll need to find some way to actually burn it out to a Blu-ray or something eventually, but I figure when I have my images on three drives, I should be reasonably safe. And once I get them into Lightroom, I flag on, or actually you can filter on unflagged items, and then I use the P and X keys on my keyboard to either accept or reject images, and it will filter away anything that has been flagged, so that eventually I'll have no images visible. I'll then turn off the flag, and in Lightroom delete all rejected images. And I'll go through that a couple of times, and that sort of puts me down to an acceptable number of images. And then I'll start grading them. I'll go through and tag anything that's not a complete disaster after I've deleted. I'll tag those with a 1. I'll filter on 1 and above, then tag reasonably good ones with a 2, filter on 2, any decent ones with 3, and so on. So, and eventually, I'll have it down to maybe, as Forrest was saying, a couple of 4s and maybe, if I'm lucky, 1 5-star picture. But those are real rare exceptions. So it's a lot of the same workflow and a lot of the same results we seem to end up at. It's just different ways of getting to the same result, really.
Yeah, I'm very similar to how you do it, Evan. It's and I guess it's all very similar to Forrest as well. So I agree. I think it's good that we all work out our the way that works the best for us, filtering things so that they float up a list or disappear altogether. Whatever works best for you. I think it's a good thing that we've got the tools now to be able to do this. A few years ago, it was a pain to do it.
Yeah, I was just now thinking that even a couple years ago, I mean, all we had just about was iView Media Pro, which I never found anything but awkward. And now, these two tools seem almost identical in a lot of ways.
Yeah. I mean, I think that we're living at the right time to be doing this. And we'll probably be looking back in 5 years thinking, geez, how do we use such archaic software? So, anyway... So, shall we move on?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so Evan, you're going to talk about when do you not take the shot?
Yeah, it's not any kind of a monologue or rant or anything from my side. It's more a matter of trying to see the thought, I guess. One of the things I've been thinking about recently is when do you, as you say, not take the shot? There's an old saying in showbiz that says you should always leave them wanting more. And I guess it sort of applies to photography as well. Sometimes I think, okay, there are a few more shots I would have liked to take, but no, I'm going to stop now because it gives me something to go back to, and B, it leaves me with a desire to take more pictures. And I think that's an important one. If you're always, for lack of a better word, fulfilled when you go out taking pictures, I think eventually there is a risk of getting bored with it, to be honest. So it's a matter of being a little hungry and a little unfulfilled. Now, you could always start arguing, when is this? I think this is more of a feeling than anything else. There was a comment on the forum that said this person found that his first and last shots of any session were normally the best ones. It's kind of difficult to remove the middle ones, but it's a matter of, I think, stopping when the going is good rather than when you're bored with it. Mm. So I'm curious to hear any thoughts on this.
I totally agree that you know, the first and the last shot are often the best. What I personally, I mean, I think it's a very interesting philosophy. I'd like to be able to walk away from a scene more readily, and I'm sure my other half would as well. you know, would like me to be able to. But I'm pretty terrible. I mean, I generally, if there's still something to shoot and I've still got the time or the energy, then I'll just go ahead and try and bag as much as I can.
Right, but doesn't that leave you with a feeling, you know, been there, done that, when you look back on it, or you come across the same place another time?
Well, I'd rather do is walk away with the best shot that I think I could have got, if I've got it. And then if I feel that I don't have it, then that'll give me a good reason to go back. But I don't always, you know, there are lots of places that I want to go and see, and having paid the money to get there and stuff like that, I don't save it for later. I can understand what you're saying and your philosophy. I don't personally, you know, walk away if I think that there's a possibility of another
right,
masterpiece sort of hiding.
Well, I'm not saying you should do this every time, but I think every now and then it's good to sort of stop and look at, okay, what am I doing here? Am I just taking pictures to sort of be sure that I've covered everything? Or am I taking pictures because I genuinely believe I can get a good shot still?
I can relate to that. I think that definitely there comes a time when I'm there and I'm thinking, okay, so I've worked this now, I've done what needs to be done, I can walk away. And I could continue to shoot, and I used to shoot a lot more just from the paranoia of the possibility of another masterpiece. So on that, you know, based on what you just said, then yes, I mean, I fully agree with that. I guess it's when you feel you've got what you want, and, you know, if there's nothing else that you can't improve on it, or, you know, I think the thing that I'm having a hard time with is the thought of leaving something for later. Just, you know, that to me is difficult.
Well, I think you'll always be able to get a better shot. I mean, if you stay in a place 1 hour, you'll get some good shots. If you stay a day, you'll get more good shots. If you stay a week, you'll get some fantastic shots.
Yeah, yeah.
So when do you stop? I guess
exactly,
we all have day jobs to go to, but you can always stay a little longer, I guess. But it's just something I've been thinking about. As I said, I don't have any hard or fast answers to any of this. It's just something to consider, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. It's very interesting. Forrest, do you have anything to say on that?
Yeah, actually, I guess at my experience level, it's sort of random each time. Usually what will get me to stop shooting something is just when the light changes enough that I don't really care for the light anymore. And I know a long time ago this kind of came up in the forums about, do you still shoot even if the light is bad? And for me, no, absolutely not. If the light is not good, then I just chalk it up to a nice memory or something. But other times, you know, I'll just stick around. And, you know, if I, as Evan said, you know, get bored of a subject, if it's still something, a subject that I knew I was interested in, I may just stick around and, you know, look at it from different angles and try a couple of test shots and, you know, try a shot without looking through the viewfinder. And I'll just kind of keep going that way.
Absolutely. That's another part of it, I guess. Sometimes you'll hit a slump and you need to work your way through it and sort of get back into taking the good shots, so to speak.
Yeah, and also this the low camera angle assignment was an interesting one for me, because that's not something I tried very much. And, you know, I take a lot of horse pictures, and usually the same horses. And so a lot of times I'll be in there in the field and thinking, you know, I've taken every photo that's possible to take of these guys. But always something happens that, you know, puts that to rest. And the low camera angle assignment was one of them, as I had never tried just putting my camera on the ground and shooting away. And it gave me a ton of photos that I thought were pretty interesting.
Yeah, that's good to hear. I definitely think that, you know, looking at things with a fresh pair of eyes, and it is going to help. And I guess, you know, if you do walk away from a place, even if you go back in exactly the same conditions, the next time you go, you're going to be a different person. You know, we all change gradually as we sort of get older and as we, you know, experience different things. So I get, and even just having a better night's sleep or a worse night's sleep is going to probably change your perspective. So there's always going to, you're going to probably see a scene differently, even if it's exactly the same scene when you go back.
Yeah, absolutely. And to more directly answer Evan's question on this, for me, it typically is the change of light that stops me during a shoot.
Mm. I think that I tend to shoot in, you know, in relatively bad light if I think that there's still something can be saved. But once it gets like too dark or it's, you know, the sun is just too harsh, then definitely I'll walk away as well.
And, you know, I only shoot with a digital Rebel XT, and I find the low light characteristics, you know, the grain characteristics, so to speak, are kind of awful compared to what I've seen with, you know, people with 5Ds. And so if and when I upgrade my camera body, that's probably going to be one of the big factors.
Well, we're all Canon people here, so I think we should try to refrain from talking about the competition, so to speak, because otherwise we could get a discussion about grain, which might not be a healthy one.
Okay. So let's see. Have we exhausted that one? Does anyone want to say anything else? Okay. Sounds like not. So I guess we can start to wrap up. We're sort of almost at 50 minutes or so. But what I was going to do was another rip-off of the Focus Ring podcasts and sort of ask if anyone has any sort of takeaways, any tips, or just a thought to leave the listeners with before we call it a day. So let's see. Do you have something for us?
Yeah, actually, I wanted to plug a website.
Hey, go ahead.
I'm on the board of directors for Red Wings Horse Sanctuary, and it's located way out of nowhere in California. And it usually gets hotter than it gets even where I live. But it's an amazing group of people that I became familiar with a few years ago. And I'm not a horse person. I hope never to be a horse person. But they just do some amazing work with horses that have been beaten or neglected. And, you know, they put their blood in, basically, to keep these horses they rescued in good shape. And their website is at www.redwings.org. That's redwing.org. And it's just an amazing group of people.
Okay. So if you, I think I've got that, but if you just send that to me on the Skype chat, Forrest, I'll put it in the show notes as well. So
okay.
Save people noting it down. So that's great. Great, sounds like a great cause as well. So Evan, did you have anything else to finish on?
Nothing major. If anyone wants to continue the discussion or tell me I'm an idiot or whatever, they can either reach me on your forum or they can go to my website, coldbluenight.com, and check out, give me feedback or whatever. I'm open to discussions about just about anything as long as it's kept civil.
Yeah. Okay. Well, if they start calling you an idiot, it's not going to be civil. But hopefully we can prevent that. I've not seen many heated conversations in the forum, so hopefully you won't get any of that.
Yeah, actually, I've been so amazed about your forum because every other forum I've been in has gotten completely out of hand multiple times, and yours I've maybe seen it a couple times and it didn't really even get that far out of hand.
I think that it's I don't know why exactly, but I'm very grateful that it's turned out to be the way it has. And I think it's just because everyone's got a lot of respect for each other. And don't, you know, the thing is that the more advanced people that sort of bless us with their presence have not sort of got so far up their own behinds that they, you know, that they feel that they can't sort of help out people that are still on the ladder. Because I think the thing is that we're all still on the learning curve. You know, we're still on that ladder, no matter how good we get or how advanced we get. And it seems like we've attracted a lot of people that that feel that way. So you don't get ridiculed for asking silly questions. And, you know, and I think that sort of all helps to keep people calm and sort of professional. It's great, though. I'm always very grateful for everyone for that. So I had one last thought that I was going to talk about. Again, it's a little bit long. Give me a minute. I was reading a book, a magazine this morning, a Japanese magazine that I picked up yesterday, about the philosophy and the history of the EOS Canon camera system. And in there, there was like it started with a passage about a chef's knife, and it showed you two pictures of a chef's knife. One was like brand new. One was the blade was like down to half the size from being sharpened over the years, and it talked about how the 10-year-old one feels good in your hand, and there was actually a word there that a Japanese word that I'd not come across before, and the word was tanagokoro, but it was, you know, it was written in a phonetic alphabet, so there was no hint in the characters as to what it meant. But I'd never heard it, and neither had my missus, which is good because she's Japanese. So we sort of looked it up, and it turns out that this word is the same word as the palm of your hand, and that's normally said as tenohira, which means basically the flat of your hand. But the new word that I'd learned there, the tanagokoro, is basically ta is the te for your hand, and but kokoro is for your mind or your heart, and you'll know this, Forest, obviously, with your
understanding. Yeah, a lot of Japanese songs have that word in it.
Right. So the thing is, the point I wanted to make here today was that this word had been used in a way as like, you know, you have feeling in the sort of, you know, the higher sense, not so much the feeling in the palm of your hand, not so much the feeling of something as in touch, but feeling as in with your heart or your mind. And it was relating this to how the EOS camera system feels in your hand. And I just felt, you know, that it was important. I mean, I often get people email me saying, I'm toiled about this or that camera and I don't know which one to get. What do you think? And one of the first things that I'll tell them is, you know, apart from the technical side, actually try to get to a store and feel it in your hand. Because a lot of the time, you know, people can now order things so easily online, you don't even get to touch the equipment before you buy it. But this new word and the thought of having feeling as in with your heart or mind in the palm of your hand really just sort of hammered home to me the importance of actually getting your gear, picking it up in your hands and feeling it, but not just with the touch, but with your mind or your heart. And so I'm just going to reiterate a piece of advice that I've given to people a lot of times in email, which is before you buy something, unless you know it's exactly right for you, try and get to a store and just feel it. Does anybody have anything to add before we finish?
Well, adding to what you just said, I think it's important that your equipment, or you become so familiar with your equipment, it becomes an extension of your mind and you don't really think about it.
Good point.
It's all about the shot. It's not about the camera or the equipment you use to get the shot.
Yeah,
that's true. I mean, I was talking earlier about using the button on the back for autofocus, and at first it was really awkward. But now, I mean, sometimes I have to stop myself from pushing that button just before taking that shot to sort of, you know, almost simulate what I had configured away. And, you know, you just do it without thinking about it now.
Cool. Okay, so I guess that's it. If we've got nothing else to talk about, we're coming up to, so we've got 55 minutes or so here, so a nice long show for everybody to enjoy. And hopefully everyone will be able to pick up some hints or some tips from this. And I guess the only thing to remain to be saying, if unless you guys have got anything else, and don't pipe up within the next few moments. All that remains to be said is thanks very much to Forrest and Evan for joining us today, and it's been great talking to you.
It's been fun.
It's been a lot of fun. Thanks a lot for setting this up.
Not at all. Thanks for taking the time to talk with us. So we'll see you again in the forum very soon. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye. I'm already recording, just in case. So, but obviously I won't use this part. I'm just really trying to practice, and hopefully if someone says something funny, we can use it for the outtakes.
So we have every chance to really screw things up for you, don't we?
Absolutely, yeah. I'll stop recording just for now, just once, and I can probably do that without killing the session. So. Famous last word. But we'll have to give him some stick when he comes back online.
yeah, it's kind of I almost mentioned him during the broadcast, right?
I was thinking, okay, we're all on the same wavelength, trying not to blame Landon for staying in bed too long this morning.
To be able to abuse him, you need to get your webpage back, so you shouldn't be speaking too loudly.
Once again, thanks, guys. It's been great talking with you.
Okay. No problem. Yeah, thank you.
All right. Thanks. Cheers, then. Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.
PhotoCastNetwork.com, your photography resource in the podosphere. PhotoCastNetwork.com.